From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Everybody likes to go to a new thing, so I think that the new casinos will do well. But if you're an existing casino, I have a lot of concern that they're really going to be impacted. This, the cannibalization could be significant to these casinos. We may at the end be maybe slightly disappointed in how much money that we're actually generating from it, but I don't think it's going to be something where we're going to look back and go, oh, we lost revenue from this.
Right now, with recreational marijuana about to be legal in Illinois on January 1st, Mayor Lightfoot's plan to limit the sale has received wide criticism.
It is believed that some developers have already been eyeing Michigan Avenue for a recreational marijuana store. Mayor Lightfoot says that will not happen.
The area along our Mag Mile and our parks is incredibly important to our hotel and tourism business. We want to make sure that those stay family friendly.
I'm a political consultant, but ever since all of my story became public, it has been obviously very difficult to get work. I spent a lot of time last year traveling and taking care of my mental and emotional health, and now with campaign season starting, I might do a little bit of political work again, but I also bartend. Now I feel like I need to take my identity back and become who I am meant to be now.
It's Elena Hampton, a former political staffer. She's talking about what's happened to her since she came forward with allegations of harassment by an employee of the state Democratic Party. We'll hear more about that. Also, the latest gambling revenue numbers show the state bringing in more money, but the mix of how people actually wager in the state is changing, just as a big gambling expansion law was recently approved. And Chicago's mayor has some ideas on where marijuana sales will be allowed, and that's been a bit controversial. We'll hear more on all of those stories and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He's the former State House reporter and now retired director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House editor. Joining the panel this week, also Maureen McKinney, IPR reporter, and Sam Dunklaw, who also reports for IPR. It's good to have both of you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let me start about the gambling numbers. And Sam, you did cover this report that was released by the state, taking a look at the last year, and it did show some good news, I guess, if you're looking at the state trying to bring in revenue from gambling. Revenue seemed to be up.
It did, yeah. So revenue increased, and we're talking about revenue, we're talking about tax revenue, the amount of taxes that the state brought in from various gambling activities. And we're talking about things like casinos, riverboat casinos. We're talking about things like racetracks, and now for the last several years, video gaming machines. The state brought in $3.5 million more dollars in tax revenue than last year, and that has been steadily increasing over the past couple of years overall, in large part because of the proliferation of video gaming machines. The slot machine parlors are popping up all over the state. We're all here located in Springfield, and Springfield just so happens to be where the most of them are throughout the state. Somebody had commented to me, Wabash Avenue here in Springfield starting to look a little bit like the Strip.
Of Las Vegas.
Of right. Las Vegas, right. That is, right. So tax money in all went up slightly by a few million dollars, but the underside of those numbers, as the charts in this report from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability shows, is that while video gaming revenue is increasing, in fact, that increased by over $40 million just from this year, from last year, revenue from casinos and racetracks, the traditional places where people have historically gone to make bets, revenue from those have been declining steadily. Precipitously over the last couple of years. And there is some concern as the state moves forward with approving six new casino licenses that not only that the casinos will not necessarily be profitable, but that we're not sure that enough people will even proliferate those casinos in order to make the money and make it worth it for the state.
Yeah, Brian, this seems to be kind of flying in the face of what a lot of these communities say they want. They want casinos. It's going to bring in a lot of revenue, and yet video gambling seems to be the way to go. So was a mistake made with this gambling law, or is it too soon to say?
Well, it's too soon to say. You know, I was just thinking to what Sam said. You know, I know Las Vegas. Las Vegas is a friend of mine, and Wabash Avenue, you are no Las Vegas Strip. But in a sense, that's what these communities have become. We all have the equivalent of a small casino. It just happens to be sort of distributed among many, many storefronts. Springfield, of course, has the most video gambling terminals of any municipality that allows it. Now, of course, Chicago does not allow it, so it's not counted in that figure. But there are, and you go to any bar, restaurant, even gas stations and truck stops in Springfield have significant video gambling operations. And yeah, it makes sense that that is going to cut into the revenue of existing casinos, and it does make it less attractive. I mean, Danville authorities have acknowledged that had the casino gone through 5-10 years ago when, you know, there were other efforts to get it in, they potentially could have made a lot more money back then. But video machines have taken hold in these places. We're going to continue to see more of them. They have been expanding year after year. The growth has slowed somewhat, but it is still growing. I think there were more than 2,000 or 3,000 video gambling terminals added in the year covered by this report. And that is the equivalent of more than two of the old land-based casinos, which used to be limited to 1,200 sort of positions, they called it. Okay. So this is, will the new law to bring in all the money people hope? There are some real questions about that.
Well, I think one of the ideas behind where most of the new casinos are going to be is to try and keep Illinoisans from going across the border to Indiana or to Wisconsin to gamble, have them stay home. Because, for example, the casino that's going in Rockford, there is going to be a Native American casino right across the border in Beloit that's being constructed. And so Rockford wants to get in the game before that casino opens so that people from Winnebago County and the surrounding area don't go across the border to gamble. Same thing with Danville. There's talk about a casino in Terre Haute, Indiana. So folks in East Central Illinois who want to gamble and maybe find it difficult to get up to the Chicago area or over to, I guess, East Peoria would be the closest, they'll be able to stay home and not go across the state line into Indiana. So that's kind of what the thought is. And the thing about, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't the new gaming law also allow existing video terminal locations to add another slot machine?
It does. It does.
And so that will be a way for the current ones to bring in more money.
Well, this seems pretty interesting to me in the sense that back in the 90s, when we saw the casinos really rise up as they came online, you saw the decline of horse racing. People didn't have to go to the horse track to bet. They could go to a casino to bet. And now we're seeing video gambling is cannibalizing that market a bit when it comes to casinos. And something else, Sam, is coming online here at some point, probably going to be next year, it looks like now, and that is sports betting in Illinois.
Right, yeah. The interesting thing about sports betting is that several states right by us, Indiana and Iowa, are starting to ramp up their sports betting networks. It's been illegal in Illinois since it's been around. And the idea behind sports betting will be you'll be able to go to places like casinos, these racinos, and potentially you'll also be able to up to 2,500 different lottery locations. You'll be able to place bets there. There is some question about when that will roll out, though, especially with our neighboring states who passed their laws far sooner than Illinois did. They're already starting to ramp up their operations. And even now as we sit here in September and this bill passed and was signed in June, we still are not very clear about when sports betting will ramp up. But there is still a question, even with sports betting legalized and about to ramp up, as to whether or not the dollars from betting will be cannibalized from different areas. I mean, is the same pot of money going to exist mm-hmm. among gamblers? It's just going to be spread out differently. That's a question that needs to be answered.
Well, we have the big casino that's, and in fact, it would be the biggest in the state, one of the biggest in the country, that's been proposed for the city of Chicago under this new gambling law. And Brian, just to get a quick update, the Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, there's been a lot of question on where she wants to see a casino located, and now she's saying one downtown would not be out of the question?
Yeah, she initially, her initial proposal or set of ideas that she put forward said it did not include a downtown location. They were all out in the neighborhoods of the city, particularly in areas that have been, how would you say, economically depressed or economically underinvested in. And the idea was she wanted something that would be a job engine in those areas and potentially bring in people who go to the casino and then maybe would stop at a restaurant or a gas station or something nearby. Some questions about whether people really actually do that when they go to casinos or if they're just sort of making a beeline from there to the interstate to get back to wherever they live. But there were a lot of people who have suggested that the mayor might be leaving money on the table. You know, you have to balance this push for economic development in the neighborhoods, which she talked about and campaigned on, with the idea that you have to sometimes put these big businesses that are meant to be amusements and attract people, you have to put them where the people are. And if you put it downtown, you're going to have more tourist traffic, you're going to have convention traffic, and things like that. And so there have been people saying she really needs to consider putting this downtown. I thought Rich Miller, the columnist and newsletter impresario who follows Illinois politics very closely, made an interesting point this week when he suggested that, you know, as so much of Mayor Lightfoot's agenda and desire to, or, you know, her wish list for improving the city's dire financial situation flows through Springfield, if she's not taking full advantage of the money-making opportunities that Springfield has already presented her with, lawmakers might be more reluctant to take additional steps that will probably be politically unpopular, additional steps to help out the city of Chicago's bottom line.
And Charlie, you're one of those people that have said before that the casino needs to be where it's more accessible to people, the people where you're trying to make the money from.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. Folks who come into Chicago for a convention aren't likely to take the L or to call up a ride-sharing company to take them down to the southeast side. One of the sites suggested is the site of the former U.S. Steelworks down in the southeast side of Chicago, along Lake Michigan. They're probably not going to do that when there are so many other close-at-hand attractions. But if they only have to walk a couple blocks and here's a casino, it's an opportunity for them to go and spend a few hours or a lot of hours and help Chicago's bottom line. And it was interesting because some of the convention operators were opposed to the notion of having a casino in Chicago because they want people, when they come to the convention, to spend time at the convention and not be in the casino.
And Brian, while we're on this subject, before we move off here, the mayor has also talked about marijuana sales, legal marijuana sales come January, not allowing those in the downtown area.
Yeah, that was something that just came out this week. She is again trying to push these sort of pot shops, I guess you'd call them, into the neighborhoods as a way to try and improve economic opportunity, particularly in neighborhoods that have been disproportionately targeted by the war on drugs, where you have a lot of African-Americans and Latino people who we know have been targeted much more than whites or non-minorities who are for the same levels of sort of minor drug use. And part of the cannabis bill that the sponsors were quite proud of is that it creates incentives and extra opportunities for people who have come from these sort of traditionally disfavored backgrounds to get sort of special opportunities to open up their own, you know, to enter into the commerce of legal commerce of marijuana in Illinois. That is going to take more time to ramp up than some of the big medical marijuana companies that are ready to just sort of put a slightly different sign on the front of their businesses or open one next door or something that's a commercial business. And so Lightfoot has said, she hasn't necessarily talked about that as being a motivating factor, but it certainly stands to reason. She also says that she wants, as we heard at the top of the show, she wants to keep the downtown business district, the Magnificent Mile, family-friendly. And I guess that kind of goes to what we were just talking about with the casinos. If you have casinos and pot shops opening up, it certainly does change the character of downtown. Then again, as people have pointed out, there are Walgreens all over downtown, and a lot of them sell alcohol, including one right there on the Magnificent Mile. Is it really that different than selling marijuana? That's something that the city council is going to have to wrestle with.
Let me switch gears now to a story that came out this week, and Maureen McKinney is with us. Maureen talked with Elena Hampton, who we heard at the start of the program. She's a former political staffer who had made allegations of harassment against a former state Democratic Party employee. This started helping move the ball rolling in this Me Too movement in state government. And Maureen, you had a chance to talk with Elena Hampton. What did she say regarding her current situation?
In terms of work?
Yeah, personally or professionally.
Okay, personally, I think she's starting to heal a little bit. She talked about really having an agonizing time right after she experienced the harassment, and going public with it was very hard for her. Now, professionally, she'd like to work on some campaigns, but has found that she virtually has been shunned because she's not getting jobs.
Now, she has a lawsuit pending as well, correct?
Yes.
And what is she alleging in the lawsuit, or what is she aiming for with that?
She's alleging that she has not been able to get jobs because of retaliation by the Democratic Party. And its campaign fund is also part of the lawsuit.
And you did talk to the party officials, including, of course, the party is chaired by the Illinois House Speaker, long-term Speaker Michael Madigan. You talked to his spokesperson regarding this. And what did they have to say?
Nothing. Nothing on point. They really pointed out what's been done since she made her complaints, but really wouldn't talk about or chose not to talk about the background situation. And I think, I mean, the party did say that Madigan has acknowledged not doing enough in the past, and they also talked about what they've done since.
And, of course, I don't know that any of us can vouch for Elena Hampton, the type of job she did, but she was employed pretty regularly working on campaigns before this. Now she's mentioned she's having to help support herself as a bartender.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it strikes me, and I'm hardly one to give advice to the speaker, but it strikes me as maybe the first off, it would be the proper thing in my judgment, but it would also be a very political thing, or a very smart political move for him to put the word out. Look, this woman is looking for work. She's got a good track record. She's a true believer in our democratic cause. Hire her for your campaign. And I think that would get her out of tending bars and put her back in the loop of doing serious political work.
Well, let me go back to the what she has alleged took place. Kevin Quinn was the employee of the state Democratic Party. He was let go, correct, after this. But she also found fault with the speaker.
Yes. She really felt that it was a culture situation. And she really felt that Madigan didn't respond when she finally sent a letter. Her complaint, as she pointed out, would have had to been to Kevin Quinn's brother, the alderman Marty Quinn. And so she had a choice of Madigan or Marty Quinn, brother. So she sent a letter to Madigan and didn't hear anything, and went to his lawyer and really fell on silence. And that's what really caused her to speak out.
And you've covered a lot of these similar issues, Maureen, especially since the Me Too movement really has picked up steam in the last couple of years. But it would seem to me, to people listening to this and kind of reading that story about what's happened to her since, that
it would send a chilling effect about coming forward, that there may be a price to pay, and it can be a pretty steep price to pay.
What she's saying now is she's feeling more comfortable of talking about it, and I think she wants to encourage people now to speak out, and that's, she says, also part of what the suit is about, you know, not chilling people.
Just to be clear on this, too, she had worked on some campaigns in the past out of state as well, but she's having trouble finding work, not just in Illinois, but in other places as well.
Yeah, she did a little bit of work on the Bob McCready campaign in North Carolina in a municipal campaign.
And Charlie, I don't want...
What I thought was particularly horrendous about this is that Kevin Quinn, her alleged abuser, was the one who was made to feel like the victim. Look at what's happened to Kevin Quinn because this woman talked about what it is that he did to her. And yet here we are, and she's still having trouble finding work. She has been the victim of harassment, and yet you didn't hear the same sort of grievances from the Democratic Party about her situation, but certainly plenty about Kevin Quinn.
I talked to a couple other political operatives who I didn't include in the story, and one of them said that exact thing, that the guy at the top, who's really responsible for the culture, hasn't had to pay any price.
Well, as I was saying before, it seems to me that the correct thing to do from an ethical standpoint, and also the smart thing to do from just the political optics viewpoint, will be for Madigan to put the word out, look, we need to hire this woman. And she was treated unfairly, and here's our opportunity to show that we recognize what happened to her is not what the Democratic Party is about. And just a word from him, and he doesn't have to publicize it, he could just call up a couple people and say, look, hire her, and it would happen.
But Charlie, in politics through the years, it seems as though people become radioactive a bit, and politicians try to stay away from controversy wherever they can. And even though she may not have been in the wrong here, it's still somebody that there's controversy surrounding her. Do you think that, I mean, you've seen that through the years.
That's all true, and that's probably why she's not getting hired yet. There may be a reluctance that, oh, we don't want to offend the speaker. But if Michael J. Madigan himself would let people know, I want this woman to be treated fairly, I want her to have a job, it would happen overnight.
Well, we'll continue to follow that. We have just a couple of minutes left here. I wanted to get into something else that came up this week. The State Fair, of course, long since passed, over a month or so now. But the State Fair in Springfield, the revenue numbers were up. I think they were up in DuQuoin as well. But, Brian, you had a chance to cover that. Despite some changes on admission prices some days, they say the fair made more money.
It did. When you look at the raw revenue numbers, the State Fair did do better this year than it has done in any year in the past, and officials were only too happy to hold a press conference this week to tout that. The State Fair, and the audited numbers won't be out until later this year, but they say they made a little more than $6.5 million, which the previous high water mark was back in 2013 when they say the fair made $6.47 million, so just a little bit less. However, when you adjust for inflation, which you have to do when you're comparing current dollar values to dollar values from the past, I mean, you know, a gallon of milk is 20 times more expensive than it was today than it was when my parents were children, probably, but it's not really a fair comparison. So when you adjust for inflation, this was not the best performing fair. That one, in fact, was still 2013, made the equivalent of more than $7 million in today's figure, about $500,000 more than what fair officials were touting from this year.
What about in terms of attendance? Because in my mind, that would be maybe even more important a figure than just the raw dollars.
It would, and attendance is even trickier. Those numbers are never audited. I went back and looked all the way back to 1993, and this year was the best year since 2014, but there was a huge drop from 2014 to 2015. Of course, that was going from the Quinn administration to the Rauner administration.
And I think admission went up, I think, during that year too, correct?
Well, admission went the actual – so there's two different ways to look at it. There's the number of tickets sold at the gate, and then there's the estimated attendance. Mm-hmm. The number of tickets sold at the gate is presumably a pretty reliable measure. The estimated attendance is kind of, as Ag Director John Sullivan said at this news conference, he sort of licked his finger and stuck it in the air to see which way the wind was blowing. So that's the number that really dropped – and changes a lot from different political administrations to political administrations. So Governor Rauner, it went way down, but he claimed that they had developed a much more accurate way of looking at that. It's back up this year quite a bit from last year. Last year was 370,000 estimated. This year is 509,000 estimated. But, you know, there have been a lot of shenanigans in the past. Miraculously, during the 4 years George Ryan was governor, attendance at the state fair blew past 1 million people. And there's the only 4 years when it was more than 1 million people.
And that was always a questionable 25. That was a questionable so, count, too. But we only have a few seconds left here, Brent. I just wanted to ask, did they talk about any type of because you went back and looked and found that the fair had lost money going back, as you mentioned, several decades. Did they talk about any type of possible plan for bringing in new revenue rather than just admission costs?
They do. They say those things are things that they're still working on. They've begun selling sponsorships for the last few years. So, you know, I don't know if we're going to have the Pepsi Coliseum coming up in a future year, but you've certainly seen advertising banners all over the fairgrounds. There are other opportunities like that. They say they want to continue to promote the state fair as an event space in Springfield. And there are certainly everything from model railroad shows to one of the big hospitals in town has a festival of Christmas decor every December. They want to get more things like that generating money for the fairgrounds. So they say they're trying to make progress there. It's also worth mentioning, as we're wrapping up this point, that the grandstand ticket performance did very well this year. They had a number of big acts, a wide variety of acts, from Snoop Dogg to Reba McEntire, and they say they actually made more money than they spent on the acts from grandstand ticket sales, which is definitely not always the case.
And as we mentioned about video gambling earlier, they're expected to have terminals at the state fairgrounds starting next year. Let's go to our notes from the field. Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, the State Department of Employment Security released the unemployment rate for August, and it shows that our unemployment is down to a flat 4%, which is 0.2% better than it was the month before. And the officials say that is the lowest monthly unemployment rate for the state on record.
Sam Dunklaw.
Erica Harold, who you might remember from the attorney general race in the last election cycle, has decided that she would not run in the congressional race that John Shimkus, Illinois' 15th congressional district representative, is not going to be running for re-election. She decided not to run in that race, and so far all we know is that State Senator Jason Plummer is the only one who's interested in running in that race.
Okay. Brian, about 20 seconds.
There was an interesting Supreme Court case. It actually happened the week before this week, but we didn't really get to talk about it at the time. It's challenging the constitutionality of Illinois' firearm owner identification law, which is basically the state law has long been you have to get a card in order to own a firearm. There's somebody who says that is a charging a fee for a fundamental constitutional right is something Illinois should not do. So potentially interesting legal challenge to Illinois' firearm owner registration.
All right. That will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and also Maureen McKinney and Sam Dunklaw. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us at NPR One. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.